David clicks the speaker on and they listen in on Tom and Bob, who are now shivering, arms crossed, frozen hands in their armpits. Bob says, "Now what the fuck do we do? Pete's fucking not going to be fucking happy about this. We might have got what he wanted, but he won't be happy when we tell him our cover was blown." "Yeah, I know. We're in deep shit," says Tom sadly. Tom guns the motor, trying to get some heat, while the fog from their breath quickly crystallizes to ice on the frigid glass. "Who the fuck is this Shay? Fucking ever heard of him?" "Nope, never. But he's protecting Mike, that's for sure. At least we know that much." Some rustling from the speakers as Tom reaches in his pocket for his cell phone and says, "We better get this over and call Pete. He won't be any happier if we stall." "You're right, do it. Put it on speakerphone so I can hear." Bob begins punching a number into his cell phone. As he hits each key, its tone is analyzed by David's computer and the digit appears in sequence on a display in the monitor. When the full number has been punched in, a tracking window appears with a map and street location of where the call is going. The destination is a landline in Des Moines. It matches the calls detected earlier by Todd. Bob switches to speakerphone mode so Tom can hear, but so too can David, Lance, Todd, and Mike. They all hear the target phone ring once, twice, three times, then click. "Hello? Pete, it's me, Bob. What'd you find out?" "Mike was here last night. He's probably there now. There are apartments up on the top floor, and he was seen last night heading up there with the owner of the place. Did anyone see him tonight?" "No, we didn't see him, and no one we talked to said they'd seen him today." "Any sign of his car?" "No." "Well, that checks. He hasn't used his credit cards today either. Anything else?" "Yeah, they were on to us when we got to the bar. I don't know how, but they knew who we were. We were there for a couple of hours, then the owner, a guy named David Shay, came after us with a bunch of bouncers. They beat us up and threw us out in the snowdrift." "What the fuck happened?" the angry voice from the cell phone demands. "It's David Shay, the owner, the one who was seen with Mike last night. He came over to us and started asking questions. He as much admitted that Mike's there. He got belligerent. Then Tom started to pull a gun on him, and then the bouncers were all over us. My shoulder's dislocated. Then they threw us into the slush and the gutter. We're all wet and freezing, Pete," says Bob, almost in tears. "You fucking dumb shits. You think I care if you're wet? This was just a simple look-and-see job. How the fuck did they do a make on you? Clumsy fucks, that's what. What else do you know about this bar owner who mugged you?" Bob sobers up for a second time. Pete, indeed, does not give a damn about him or Tom, or whether Bob's shoulder is dislocated, or whether they're lying in slush or not. Bob and Tom both know they're just roadkill as far as Pete's concerned. "Just his name. Shay. David Shay," says Bob, taking a deep breath and trying to regain his composure. "Ah, I think I remember a guy by that name from St. Louis a few years ago. There may be a little unfinished business there." Then the voice in Iowa says, "Hold on a minute," and they hear a hand muffling the phone. After a while, the phone is unmuffled, and they hear someone on the other end talking to Pete, saying, "You bet, we can do that." The voice on the other end growls, "Okay, shitheads, back to your motel and wait. Looks like I need to go over there and sort this fucking mess out myself. Do you think you can be at Joe's warehouse at 11 tomorrow without pulling a gun on someone or tripping over your own dicks?" "Yeah, 11 o'clock. We'll be there," says Bob as the line goes dead. Tom and Bob sit in silence as the engine slowly warms up. Then Bob says, "Man, we better be careful. Real careful. People we work for don't give a shit about trash like us." "Yeah, I know. I know guys like us are expendable," says Tom as he puts the car in gear. Belts screeching. It rattles out of the parking lot and bounces onto the snow-covered street. They return to their seedy motel, stopping at a convenience store along the way for cigs, beer, and chips. Time, 10:15 p.m. At David's apartment, as he and the other guys go to listen to Tom and Bob, Mary walks in and sits next to David. "Go peel me a grape, honey." "Go peel your own grape. This is important." She gives him a dirty look and gets up and heads for the kitchen, where she opens a cabinet and pulls down a bottle of something red and very expensive. She takes it, an opener, and a long-stemmed goblet back to the living room and hands the bottle and opener to David, who does the honors. He pours her a libation, then shuts down the audio feed from Tom and Bob's car. He turns to Mike and says, "Who's this Joe they're referring to at the warehouse?" "Joe runs the show over here in Omaha. The warehouse is his base of operations. It's over next to the railway yards. The place is a front. To the outside world, he runs a paper distributorship. His trucks cover half Nebraska, South Dakota, and western Iowa, with long-haul routes to Mexico and the East Coast. With the tie-in to the freight yards, it's a perfect cover. He runs a massive amount of drugs, of all kinds, all across the country. He's one of the really big middlemen nationwide. You know, it takes a big operation to distribute 500 metric tons of cocaine a year, not to mention the meth. There used to be 8,000 meth cookers in Missouri alone a few years ago. Who knows how many tons? That's a lot of pickup and delivery points. Discount Mart should have such a supply network. Who's the guy they called Pete? I'm guessing he was the one who called Omaha last night. That's Pete Evans, one of Jack's lieutenants. He's a guy I worked with for a while in Des Moines. He runs the show there, and he's coming here, it appears. When he needs to have some dirty work done, he travels with a couple of guys named Mark Schultz and Sid Wagon, some foot soldiers he always counts upon. I expect they'll be with him. What kind of dirty dirty work. You mean like killing people? Asked Todd. Yep, that's what he wants done. That's what they do. What's their full names again? I'll try to see what I can find on them. Asks Todd. Sid Wagon, Mike Schultz, and Pete Evans from Des Moines, and Joe Schmidt from Omaha. David looks at Mike and says, okay, tell me more about the warehouse. Just what it sounds like. An old warehouse near the railroad tracks. They collect and store the drugs there for distribution. Very clever operation. Everything looks perfectly normal. Delivery trucks, regular staff. The police have no idea. Here, I'll give you the address. Mike picks up a pad of paper and writes down the address. David takes it, looks at it, hands it to Todd, who looks at it, then passes it to Lance. David keys the address into a mapping program, which brings up a detailed satellite view of the warehouse and its immediate surroundings with street names overlaid. David looks back to Todd and Lance and asks, either of you know it? What do you think? Nope. I know that part of the town. Probably driven past it, but I don't know the place specifically, says Lance. Me neither, says Todd as he turns to Mike and asks, any idea where they might meet this Pete from Des Moines? Sure. In Joe's office. It's on the first floor, southwest corner. Windows? Yeah, facing southwest, but they're all painted over. Are they storm windows or double paned? No, just plain old glass with putty. That warehouse was built in the 30s. Good. Then turns to David and says, I think we can handle it from across the street next to that parking lot. What are you going to do? Asks Mike. David says, we're going to fasten a small radio transponder on the outside of the window and retransmit the signal from a van parked on the street. We should be able to hear everything they say. Turning to Mike, David says, this is getting complicated. Just then, Todd's phone rings. It's one of the bartenders downstairs. Flipping his phone shut, he says, I think your girlfriend is here. Sean says there's a girl downstairs that fits her description. Come on, let's go out and take a look, says David. They all get up and head out to the balcony. Mike scans the floor below. It's nearly 11:30 p.m. and the crowd is thinner and more desperate. David says, they say everyone looks better at closing, or so the story goes. It's just a story. By closing time, they just all look drunk. Jessica arrived late that evening by bus. She managed to hitch a ride from downtown Omaha out to an intersection a few blocks from the club. From there, she hiked through the dark streets, arriving half-frozen a little after 11. At the bar, she ordered some hot coffee and began anxiously scanning the crowd to see if she could find Mike. From the balcony above, Mike finally spots her, slouched on a bar stool, clutching her oversized backpack and drinking her coffee. He points her out to the others. Todd flips open his cell phone, hits a button, and in walkie-talkie mode, talks to somebody below. One of the bartenders nods and moves quickly towards Jessica. The bartender leans over and says, is your name Jessica Gannon? She nods. Then he says, see that door over there? There's an elevator behind it to the top floor. Jessica gets up, puts her drink on the counter, and says, that door over there? Why do I want to take an elevator to the top floor? If you look up there, as he points to the balcony, you might just be able to see your friend Mike waving. Go on over. Somebody will show you the way up. Jessica looks up and dimly sees some figures on the balcony high above. She puts her coffee down and, swinging her heavy backpack over her shoulder, walks timidly across the dance floor. At the door to the elevator is Jim, one of the bouncers. He nods, opens the door, and says, follow me. Jessica looks at him and decides that resistance is futile and enters not really knowing what's going on. Once inside the elevator, Jim drops the gate and hits the button for the fifth floor. The elevator winds upwards. Jessica Gannon is of average height, straight dark brown hair tied in a ponytail with a yellow beaded elastic loop. She's wearing a dark red parka with a fur-lined hood and jeans tucked inside her fur-lined boots. Her dark blue bulging backpack heavily strains on its strap hoisted over her shoulder. While her lips show the faint but not recent application of lipstick, there is no other evidence of makeup. A knit red stocking cap with a tattered pom-pom of red yarn at its apex is tucked under one of the backpack straps. Upon reaching the top floor, Jim opens the gate and points across to the right. Jessica steps out and sees Mike and the others. Jim waves, drops the gate, and the elevator descends. Jessica rushes to Mike and gives him a hug and says in her northern New England twang, hey, Mikey, I thought I was being shanghaied. You obviously made it here okay. What happened to your hair? Holy crap, you've got decent clothes on, too. What, you got kidnapped by yuppies along the way? I'm fine, Jay. Made it here okay. How about you? I was kidnapped by the fashionistas. Don't worry, I won't let it happen to you. I'm not sure how I'm going to take that. I'll tell you later. He turns and said, I want you to meet David. This is Jessica Gannon, Jay for short. Guys, glad to meet you, says Jay as she shakes hands and says to Mike, this is that guy you knew from college, right? Have you explained to him what's happened? Mike says, right, that's him, and yes, I filled him in. And this is Mary, the real boss. That's Todd. Who's the big guy? This place got a football team or something? My name's Lance, and I keep the pencil neck geeks out of trouble, says Lance, reaching out and shaking her hand. Oh, he's really our steroid tester, says Todd. One more crack about steroids and it's over the balcony, geek boy, growls Lance. Todd glares with an I'll get even look and says, okay, jock boy, stuff it. My lasers are programmed to protect me. Okay, enough already. Back in the apartment. Let's go sit down and figure out what happens next, says David as he points them back into the apartment. Once inside, Jay, looking around the apartment, says, whoa, what a wicked place, dude. Heading for the kitchen, David says, glad you like it, soda, I think. What are you drinking? Got any gin and quinine? David, reaching into a cabinet and pulling out a bottle and a glass, pours it and says, this is a bar. Yeah, we got gin and tonic. Only in New England do they still call it quinine. He fetches a bottle of tonic water from the fridge. Well, that's what it is. Anyway, tonic means soft drink, or what you provincials call pop. What, no lime? What kind of a bar is this? David reaches back into the fridge and takes out a plastic bottle and squirts some green-yellow juice into the glass and says, there, that's lime. Then, looking at Mike, says, geez, did you invite any more of your irritating limey friends? No, just her. She should be enough. Hey, I'm Scott. Watch the limey thing, says Jay as she wanders around, surveying the apartment in detail.